What do you think it means to be a person?
I don't know.
Me either.
Really.
Say scratch that again.
Scratch that again.
I'm Caitlin Metz, a non-binary illustrator and designer.
I'm Rebecca Tossig, a disabled storyteller and writer.
And this is Scratch That, Parenting and Reparenting Off Script.
A podcast for people trying to parent and person at the same time.
Head over to our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast, for show notes and a transcript of today's episode, and also to join the conversation.
Thank you for being here. Hi, friends.
Happy Monday.
We're here with a guest that I have been a wee bit obsessed with for years and years, and I can't even remember how many years. We are welcoming Barry Lee to the pod today. Barry is a disabled illustrator, artist, writer. You have a new book out that I'm sure we will talk about today called The Gentle Reminders Journal. We have a link in our show notes, so definitely check it out. But Barry, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you all for having me. And yeah, I think the first time that we talked was when you released your book.
I remember a Zoom that we had with your beautiful plants in the background and your gentle, beautiful presence. But I don't even remember where how I originally found you, but it was years before our conversation. For me, the initial grab was the distinct art style that you have. If you're not already familiar with Barry's work, it's vivid and colorful and whimsical. It's like a whole world that you've created with all these characters. But I think what has definitely kept me hooked in, like, following your Substack all the years later and reading everything that you put out and following you, is the intention and the values and the person behind these creations, this art. So we're definitely going to dive into those values and intentions, the person and the art today. But if you are okay with it, we just kind of want to dive into the heart of these questions because we have so many things we want to talk to you about.
Let's do it. Yeah.
One of the things that I've really been dying to talk to you about for a long time is these overlaps in our childhoods that you and I share.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I'm getting emotional about this. Okay. Both you and I spend a lot of our early years in medical spaces as patients.
Yes.
I remember distinctly a Substack essay you wrote. I mean, it was probably like over a year ago, but I think about it often. And in this essay, you talk about just this like deep and lasting disembodiment that you experienced through those early years in medical spaces. And I think that humans, there are a lot of ways that we learn to disembody, but reading the way you wrote about it and talked about it felt so uniquely familiar to me, distinctly familiar to me. And so I just feel this link to you, this bond with you in this origin, part of our origin stories. And so I'm just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about little Barry and how you learned to separate from your body, kind of what some of those early experiences were, and maybe if it seems relevant, like when you even learned that you were disembodying.
Right. I think that, yeah, I agree. I think when reading your work as well, I was like, oh, cool. Like, I'm so glad that, like, I'm not the only one talking about this, these aspects, because I think that so many children who grow up disabled and who grow up in medical surveillance don't realize, like, that you can have these feelings.
Yes.
Like, you can be like, this is actually kind of messed up. So, yeah, I was born with a very rare syndrome called Nager syndrome, which caused me to immediately have surgeries as soon as I was born. I mean, throughout my whole childhood, even into my teenagehood, it was just surgeries. And it was very normal for me to have like a whole day at the doctor's office where we saw the audiologist, we saw the ENT, we saw this person, we saw that person. And this doctor had, you know, maybe like 7 medical students with him, and they're all just like looking at you, and they're all just like with their little notepads. Like, and it's weird. It's so weird. And it was just so, so typical for me and for you, right? Like these, and it's so funny to be like, to meet people who have never even had a surgery. I'm like, what? Like, what is that?
What is that like?
What? So I think that, I mean, I would say it took me, I would say like 27 years from birth, right? Until 27 to be like, oh, I want to learn how to be more in my body. Because so many times it felt like my body was not mine. It was for the examination of other people. And even like not just on a medical basis, but even when I'm out in public and strangers would be like, why do you have this device on your head? Like, and the entitlement that they had, but also the willingness that I had to be like, yeah, you know, like no real understanding of what boundaries were or anything like that. And I remember when I was 25, like I had done a very intimate portrait show that like really talked a lot about those experiences. And it was this pendulum swing that I was like, well, if I'm just going to be out and disabled, I'm going to like really push it and just like bear all. And that's what I did. And, you know, 25-year-old me, bless their heart. And I'm glad, I don't regret doing that show, but I also noticed that when I was so much of an open source, I really got met with a lot of people's secrets, a lot of people's stories. And I was like, whoa, okay, wait a minute. Like, I'm already holding so much. And I also can't hold this, right? Like, you can't hold your things too. All of that to say was like around 27, 28. And when the pandemic started, when we were in lockdown, the lockdown portion of it was when I was like, okay, I have a lot of alone time. I am also genuinely unsure how COVID would impact my body because of my syndrome being so rare. So I was like very much staying in isolation. And I was like, oh, I have a lot of time with myself. And I remember visiting my parents, and my mom shared with me this journal that she had written while I was born and like up until maybe about age 4, which like cataloged all the things that I was navigating. And that was sort of like a clicking moment of being like, I don't remember any of this. I do not remember who they were as a child. And yeah, so I started to really want to sit more with being in my body through meditation and all of that. And so like learning to do that and learning to kind of hear the context clues of pain and things like that, I was like, oh, like I'm actually in much more like physical pain than I'm letting myself admit, right? Oh, I have like migraines a lot. Okay. All right, that's weird. And to like going into meditation, there are so many people, so many meditation teachers that want you to avoid the pain in your body and who are very ableist and who are very like anti-community in a lot of ways. So I like had to really dive into some people that like resonated with me and resonated in the fact that like what my body experienced was trauma. What I'm trying to do is move with my trauma and not like bypass it. Right. And yeah, just really learning to be in my body. And it took, and it is still a process. No expert in it by any means.
That's kind of what I wanted to ask you as well, is about like the, what the everyday of it looks like now, because, oh my gosh, similarly to you, I think for me, a big shift was also finding like the trove of records and looking at this, looking at these photos. There were like photos in my medical charts of me receiving treatment.
Yeah.
And like my face, I like recognize my face and my expression, but like what was happening for you, and that I don't remember being there. And anyways, side note. So, but what I'm curious about, because I feel like, so that was like an awakening for me of being aware of how often I'm not present in my body, and starting to be aware of like how much more pain I'm in every day than I was clocking or accepting.
Yeah.
But I still really struggle now, even with that awareness, to practice an embodiment, like to actually do it and with any consistency. Can you talk about what that is like for you? Like, what does it feel like when you're doing it? How do you maintain? Are there practices that you do to pull yourself? Is it hard for you? Like,
it's so hard for me. Yeah, it's so hard for me. Like, so I think a big catalyst for me was when I like had a massive headache a couple of years ago, that to the point where I was like, content warning, projectively vomiting every hour, to the point where I had to call the ER. And I was like, is this COVID? Like, is, because I was like, I don't know how it would affect my body. At that time. But it turned out that there was I had a subdural hematoma in my brain due to a cyst in my brain that my parents forgot to tell me about, from doctors that forgot to keep track of it, because yeah, very casual, but you know, like it's complicated because it's like there was so much to keep track of, and I'm sure for you too, Rebecca, like there was so much for me to keep track of.
Yes. And also I think there's this piece of like when you're rare, when there's no template.
Yeah.
I have also felt like, who's keeping track of all this? No one. Me. No one.
So like that basically almost killed me. And I had to have a span of 3 brain surgeries in the span of 2 weeks to remove that out of my brain.
And this was relatively recently, right? Like just a few years ago.
This was like 2023. Yeah. Fairly recent. So I'm so glad that like I listened to my body instead of being like, I'm just going to avoid this and take more Tylenol, you know, because like Lord knows. But, and I say that because like when you are at least somewhat aware, your body will know. When you need to get the help,
it will tell you.
It will tell you. It's going to be like, hey, something's not right.
Yeah, but Barry, I feel like for Kit, I wonder if this is true for you, but I think a piece of it for me is like, we learned really early not to listen to our bodies because they had to put the needle in our arm.
Yep,
because they had to put the mask over our face and the anesthesia or whatever it is, you know, like, so that, yes. Yeah, so that practice of like, I can't listen, we have to keep going, is so ingrained.
It is so ingrained. And that's such an unfortunate thing to be brought up in, right? That's the symptoms of the society we live in. And how do we disrupt that? I think it's by really doing our best to understand as a practice and not like a consistent thing, right? I love using the word practice for so many things, and that includes like learning to be in my body, because practice gives you grace and it reminds you that at any moment you can shift, right? At any moment you can be like, hey, have I listened to my body in a second? Like, do I need to make like an alarm on my phone to be like, check in with your body? Because you might have to do that, right? Like, truly, like, how are you feeling? Taking a moment to be like, so I think that could be a good way for folks who are more curious about learning, because it's something that I'm still figuring out. It's something that even after such a traumatic experience, like, I'm still having to figure out. And a big part of that for me is like now navigating long COVID. Like my brain fog has been really bad. And like, that's really impacting how I'm moving. And at the same time, like the practices that I've been doing have at least gotten me to the point to even recognize that.
That's just a massive step. I mean, I think even the awareness is a big piece. As you guys were talking about what it is, like the practice of embodiment and coming back to yourself. And for me, one of the tools that I use in that is art making. And so I wanted to ask how your work ties into that. And so as I was going, like poring over your work, I see your work being like really beautiful without being precious. It's like whimsical, but it's sturdy. It's absolutely absurd and also deeply relatable. It's disrupting beauty standards while being like fucking stunning. And it feels, so this is about like embodiment. This feels about queerness, this like art practice, but it feels like the way that Bell Hooks talks about queerness as being like the self that's at odds with everything around it, that has to invent and create and find a place to speak and thrive and live. And so my question is like a conglomeration of like, how does queerness impact your art practice? How does your art practice impact embodiment?
Well, I, first of all, used art as a mechanism to be out in the world as a disabled person, right? Like, I was the art kid, you know, in school. So like, I mainly used art as sort of like my defense mechanism from like getting picked on or asking questions, because at least I would draw, right? Like,
this makes total sense to me. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it really started as this sort of like, especially like in elementary school and middle school, it was totally the defense mechanism, right? And then as I grew older and started learning about other artists and how they used art as a ways of self-expression, then I was like, cool, I'm going to do that too. And that's what I was doing in high school, was talking about my experiences, but in like a very garish, grim way. Like I was very inspired by our problematic fave Salvador Dali and like, you know, like surrealist artists who used a lot of symbolism and things like that. So I really was drawn to that aspect of things and art. And when I went to pursue an illustration degree, I continued that sort of dark path. But then it was interesting because, and I've been sitting with this a lot lately, actually, is like, I remember a professor being like, she was like, this is great and all, but like, people are miserable all the time. And she was like, what can you do to like, get people out of misery, right?
Wow.
And yeah, wow, to some degrees, right? But like, wow, like you want me to avoid my personhood, right? Like,
yeah.
For the sake of capital.
How did that feel in the moment?
At the moment, it felt at that time, like I was maybe 19 years old, right? Your baby. And like at that time, it felt kind of decent because I was like carrying that, right? I was just carrying it. So it kind of like felt permission to let it go a little bit. Because again, like here I am in college in a whole new city. I don't have to go to any doctor's appointments anymore. So woohoo, like Freedom.
That's all. I guess that's over.
Yeah, right. No, literally, that was like my thought process. So I was like, if that's over, then I don't have to talk about this shit anymore. And in retrospect, it did help me get to the style where I'm at today. And it took that plus the context and melding that together to get to where I am today. So it's like, yes, thankful ultimately for that pause.
Wait, say more about the context.
Mm-hmm. So the context just meaning like making personal art, making art that's...
Oh, I see. So when that teacher initially said, like, how can you help people be not miserable, did that shift your art making to be less personal? And you had
it definitely did.
So you ended up taking some of what that teacher was guiding you towards, but then finding your way back to a piece of you that you lost in the process. Oh, wow.
Absolutely. And not every project is about disability, you know, not every project is about that. But what I always say about like the work that I have is that it leads people ultimately to these themes in some way, right? Like it's the bridge to the deeper stuff.
The first layer, when you look at it, it's like this whimsy, it's play, it's bright. But when you like look for a second, you're like, oh my God, there's like so much here. And it's like, there's these layers, but I definitely feel like you have this like light entry point that like pulls you in. And then it's a little like this bait and switch gut punch, which I love. That's my favorite type of art making.
Gut punch, but like in the gentlest kindest way. Like invitation way.
Yeah, I really try. Yeah.
It just made me think of an art professor who told me that my work made her feel like she needed to puke rainbows. And she really detested how like sweet my work was.
What? What does that even mean?
Your guess is as good as mine. But it's funny how these professors can like really fuck you up a little bit. But I think the way that I've come back around to that is that my work does feel really sweet. And then I'm like saying something like I'm like cursing and it's like kind of ultimately a little bit dark. But like it's always like pink and soft.
It's holding on to the tension. I see that in both of your work, like the, and that is a value in my work that I try to do in writing too, which is that like all of these things in life, the pain and the beauty, and they're usually like intertwined and pushed right up next to each other. Like this is what it is to live inside of a moment as a human is both of these things. And I think you both do that in such different ways, but like stunning ways. To be able to hold on to both of those things.
Thank you. And I think that's accessibility. I think that is accessibility in terms of how we can create something that's inviting that will hold depth in the long term and in the long run. Is that like, it's not just going to smack you right upside the head the moment you see it. Because when I was younger, I wanted that. I wanted like this like garish, look at this dark feelings, you know. And even just like, and I don't know, Rebecca, if this is something that you ran into as well, but when I did try to like, I joined Facebook groups with people who had the same syndrome as me. I noticed off the bat that like people would just be like, I'm so-and-so. I had 27 surgeries and people bullied me all the time. And da, 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 and I like baseball. Like, you know, like, and that's not to say that those aren't things that should be communicated, but like the sort of like upfrontness of what my trauma was like at the center instead of what I'm actively moving with and how that's shaping who I am.
Literally, we learned to introduce ourselves by listing our diagnoses and our surgeries. That's what we learned to do. I see that all around me. Even now, I was speaking at this company and they asked me some question about like my childhood and I literally rehearsed the script
And I was like, where did that come from? It just came out of me. But Barry, I've never felt like crying when someone defined accessibility before. Like the way that you are thinking about that, I think is pretty different than what we normally hear, right?
Me too. Yeah.
I want to sit in that spot and I want to add queerness into that.
Yes.
So like how does your definition of accessibility, and accessibility I think is about disability, and it's also about like, it's about what the fringe, the people on the fringe, and you are in the intersection of a lot of these. I just want to hear more about how that all feels to you.
Gender-wise, I think that when I started to really, again, learn how to be more in my body, it was when I was like, oh, I'm non-binary. Like, oh, yeah, that totally makes a lot of sense. And in like retrospect, I was performing so much. I was like trying to be the different version of what I was assigned to at birth. I was like, I want to wear a nice suit every day. I want to overperform these things instead of like understanding and dismantling these aspects of myself. And like, because I think, you know, disability, right, asks us to dismantle so much, as does gender. And if we are open to those invitations, then we follow the assignment. And sometimes we have to follow that assignment. Like I had to, because it felt way too uncomfortable to not live an embodied life, to be in that practice. And the gender stuff is still hard. Like, I will still get misgendered all the time, no matter how many times I'm like, my pronouns are they, them, no matter how many times I'm wearing a damn pin, you know? Like, people are not being conscious of anything other than the binaries that they are in. And that includes disability as well, and being conscious of that. And I think those two things deeply intersect for me, because my existence confronts you in being more conscious about the world around you. And thank God, you know, like I don't want to live in the unconscious manner that I had before. Like, I look back and I'm like, was always missing pieces. There was always things that just felt missing.
Interrupting this episode to say thank you to everyone supporting the podcast on Patreon.
We love seeing your comments come through. We love getting to know each of you better. Like, you being there really means the world to us.
If you want to support the project financially, you can become a paying patron for as low as $5 a month. That's less than a latte.
But there's lots of free ways to support the podcast too. Sharing episodes, giving us one of those very pretty 5-star reviews, all of that makes a huge difference too.
And you can also join Patreon without paying, so the show notes will always be there for you. Okay, back to the show.
The way that you're talking about it reminds me a lot of some of the language we use on this podcast about script writing. And like, you use the word dismantling, and I think a word that we use a lot is like script revision or rewriting a script. I am wondering if you could talk about the scripts that, if you could name some of the scripts that you feel like you are pushing against in your work, whether that's around disability or gender or something else, like what are the new scripts that you are wanting to put into the world?
Something that immediately popped up for me is moving away from palatability.
Talk more about that, Barry. We want to hear you talk more about that.
It's something that I'm still navigating and still like trying to, you know, be with, is like this idea that we have to perform these structured roles, right? Is, you know, and that we had to perform the good disabled person. We can't speak up too loud. We can't, we can't tell somebody that they're like ableist, like that they're,
or even maybe just say no.
Yeah, we can't say no.
Yeah, just the other day, just like 2 days ago, I was rushing to pick up a birthday cake at the store, and this older guy asked me if he could help me put my chair in my car, and I was like, I got it, man. Thumbs up, smile on my face, and he was pissed. He was pissed. Anyways,
he couldn't be his good deed.
I feel, yeah, exactly. Like, how dare you disrupt this world I'm living in where I'm the hero? Yes. So you're saying, like, our resistance to that, or our, like, not conforming to that role is
unpalatability. Yeah. I think so.
Well, it's like getting comfortable with making or allowing people to be uncomfortable. It's not like we're not moving around the world like actively trying to make you uncomfortable. It's just I'm not going to extend all of my energy to make you comfortable.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Like I'm not actively trying to like ruin your day. I'm just not going to use up my limited resources to make you feel comfortable that I exist here.
Well, and can I also add, I think what it is like learning to be comfortable being disruptive, right? Mm-hmm. We're disrupting the script. We're disrupting expectation. And I think sometimes that is not always just ruining someone's day. Sometimes that's liberating the people around us who witness it as well. Because I feel that when other people do that, right? I feel when other people are disruptive and sort of embody them, you know, like are the sturdy presence of themselves in a way that seems to disrupt the flow, I feel a little bit of relief.
Yeah, it is a relief. Yeah, it is a relief because it's ultimately a performance, right? Like it's a, at least to me, it feels like it's a performance that I have to like be on the edge and anticipate for. That thus makes it a performance. That makes it feel like, oh, I'm following a script instead of just living. And it's like, oh, well, I have to explain myself all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't either, friend. You don't either. We don't have to do this. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Are there other scripts?
What are the things you're moving towards versus just what you're going against?
Whoa.
Dude, I had in grad school, I spent all of grad school like deconstructing gender and leaving fundamentalist religion. Like that was what I did in my MFA program. And I had someone say to me like, Caitlin, I know what you are against. I know what you're not for, but like, what is the thing that you, well, like, what is the thing that you're for? And that has like stuck with, I mean, that was like, oh my God, that was like maybe a decade ago. And that just has not left me because it's really easy to be like, fight the power and like, yes, let's do that. But also like, what am I running towards versus like, what am I running away from?
Right. I think for me, it's running toward more intentional care. And when I mean intentional care, it's like taking the time to like consider that somebody's pronouns are something other than what they might look. It's making sure that you're masking in spaces so that you or anybody else doesn't get sick. It's making sure that like, we understand that, like, we don't just have neighbors in houses, but we also have homeless neighbors. We have our neighbors on the streets, getting to know them as well. Those are aspects, and these are things that I'm still actively working on that I want to bring to the table, and that, like, I and are people that I want to surround myself with that are bringing around that table too. I've been thinking a lot about like really getting clear about what are even my values, because like that's a hard thing to put together, but it is something that we need to be considering as like fascism only gets louder in the society that we're in.
As I read your bio, I was so struck that like the first line in it is that you're a creative problem solver, which made me so excited. This is something that I bring to my students. I teach like freshman and sophomore design classes. And we talk a lot about the fact that we are creative problem solvers. And the problem is twofold. It first is like, what is the problem we're trying to solve with design? But then it's also a problem that I'm handing you is the constraints of the project in itself. What I want to ask you is like, what is your relationship to these constraints and limitations? And how do those limits like offer an invitation or an opportunity for this like scrappiness, creativity, trickster energy?
Yeah. Something, first of all, that I think is imperative and crucial is that like being born disabled has always asked me to be more creative, to consider the alternatives and to consider the pivots. Not in like the I'm not giving up kind of way, because I think that there is that narrative that like, just don't give up, like triumph over. Like it's being radically honest and being like, I actually don't know what the hell I'm doing. I need to ask you or somebody else, like, what's going on? So it's like being radically honest in our capacity and what we're capable of and what we're not is definitely a tool for me with that. And it makes me think, too, about, like, creatively, it reminds me of a professor I had who talked about how she liked to not think outside of the box, but to think about how many ways she can rearrange what's in the box.
Oh, I love that.
That
is so good.
I need to draw that.
Right? Just like, how can you rearrange what's in the box? Like, how many times? What else?
Yes. What else? How else? Yes.
How else? And, you know, really, I think it's the Miriam Kaba quote. Miriam Kaba said, if something can't be fixed, what can we build instead?
I love that in relationship to disability. That's there's such an obsession with fixing the body. And I suppose that relates to gender, too. Like,
we are forced into boxes that ultimately just don't work out for us. And people keep trying to force us into boxes instead of being like, why don't you just build your own box and we help you figure that out, right? Like, I think so often about being a child who didn't have the option to not have a hearing aid. My parents didn't want to learn ASL. So we're just like, okay, hearing aid, speech therapy, all this stuff. And I see so many problems now where like people don't know I'm deaf because of the amounts of speech therapy I've had. The eugenics, I mean, that's like a eugenics thing, is like masking my disability. And then when I'm in emergency situations where my hearing aid is overheating and not starting, I'm screwed. So, yeah, I think deeply about the boxes that we're forced into versus people being willing to build a new box.
Yeah, because the fixing refers to a brokenness and needing to return to something that's right. And this, like, if it can't be fixed, maybe we build something instead. Like, yeah, I think it's the implication that it's broken. And then could we create something else in its place?
Yeah, I was literally watching a video this morning where somebody was talking about a disabled person, but the way that they were talking about them was like, they suffer from disability. Like, the language of like, they suffer from that. It's like, did they tell you they're suffering? Like,
it's built into the lexicon that they're suffering. Yeah. Yeah. The narrative is built into our language. Yeah. Yeah. Something, and I don't know if this will resonate with either of you, but something I've been thinking about a lot lately as my pain has been becoming a larger part of my life experience is accepting, admitting that there are parts of my body that are
are suffering. That it's not actually, I can have the right context and I'm still in pain. And I think the other piece of that, I think that both of these things are deeply true at the same time in my perspective, that the context is a huge part of what creates unnecessary suffering. And also, I think suffering is a little bit human. I think pain is a little bit human. And I think what rankles me about the suffering from whatever disability is like, as if you're not suffering, like as if suffering is only a part of disability, like that.
Right.
That we're all in different kinds of pain. And also, what are the parts of pain that we can alleviate? Like, what's the unnecessary part of the pain? And what is the human? And being mindful of that and getting rid of these, like, I mean, again, it feels like boxes, right? Like, these people are in pain and these people aren't. And I don't know. Anyways.
Yeah, I think, you know, this idea of disability feeling outside of possibilities and only as a form of punishment. I think a lot of people see disability as punishment. And because even when like anybody would hear that I would go through surgeries or that I am just disabled, people would do, I'm sorry. Like, what? Like
the instinct response, the script, the thing that I say next once I hear about your, yes, once I hear about this is, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Right. And so I think that like we are still sadly in a space where it's like we are naming disability as punishment, like the idea of disability as punishment, when like, you're right, Rebecca, like pain is just a part of human life. Pain is a part of our existence. And some disabled people feel pain and non-disabled people feel pain.
And some disabled people don't have, I mean, the kind of pain that I experience or maybe you experience. I mean, that's, yeah, right? It's just, yeah, it's just different and we move in and out of it. And
it feels like removing the layer of like shame or expectation from being on top of the suffering or the need to like pretend that you aren't suffering is what adds the intolerableness of it, at least in my experience. When I am like suffering, which my suffering is usually mental, not physical, but it's like the layer of shame that I feel on top of it is what makes it, that's what sends me over the edge. And so, and that feels like these scripts, and not to say like that we aren't suffering, but to remove the shame about the fact that we are.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because it's like, okay, not only are you suffering, but you need to be alone in it, or you are like wrong because of it, or you don't belong here because of it, or you're yes, like all the narrative that goes on top of it. As opposed to like, oh, love, you're human. You're, you know, like be with us in your humanness. Let's be together in our humanness, you know?
Yeah, we need to be in grief with each other. Like, we need to have that. And unfortunately, like, the systems in place don't let us hold grief. They don't let us hold these feelings of pain. And then that's what then makes us feel the need to, like, name it in that way, because we're...
And I think numbs your experience or capacity to feel joy or like to move through the world. Like the more that I'm able to hold and experience grief and not shut myself off to it, the more that just like staring at the sky is like transcendent. It's like the opener I am to the channels of like whatever is coming to me.
Barry, just to close out, we like to ask our guests about a song that has held you or grounded you. We'll add it to our Scratch That playlist. Are there any songs that come to mind of a song that is just making you feel like Barry, bringing you back to yourself?
Okay. Well, I was going to do like a whole album, but then when you said it brings me back to myself, I thought about thought about The Rainbow Connection by Kermit the Frog.
Oh, my fucking God.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Barry, we're really excited for people to check out this Gentle Reminders journal. I think a lot of the things we talked about today, I think of the journal as being a prompt for people to think through some of these questions for themselves. I think of this journal as the coziest, brightest invitation for people to reflect and to do some of the record keeping that Caitlin and I talk about a lot on this podcast. I wonder if there are any things that you want to say about the journal, if there's anything you want our listeners to know about it.
Yeah. So the Gentle Reminders Guided Journal is a journal that I developed last year for about like 2 years. And really, it's a journal that not only asks us to like consider ourselves, but to consider our community and the future. I think a lot of guided journals specifically don't really consider community and are very much absorbed in self-care versus our impact of care of ourselves and others. And so I really wanted to try to create something to start to get people more curious about community care, especially as we just head deeper into the unknowns that we're in right now.
Beautiful. We'll make sure there's a link up in the show notes. And Barry, where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Barry Lee Arts. And on my website, barryleeart.com, and on Substack, which is also barryleeart.substack.com.
I love your Substack. All right.
go follow.
Okay, perfect. All right, I'll talk to you all soon.
Bye, friends.
Bye.
You tell me when we're done, okay?
This podcast is edited and perfected by the most beautiful wizard and my favorite dude, Micah Jones.
For all the show notes and a transcript of today's episode, check out our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast. This is our hub. It's where you can join the conversation and be part of our community.
If today's episode resonated with you or made you think of someone, share it.
And if you want to support the pod and also make us glow inside, go give a 5-star review on Apple. That would be so lovely.
Thank you for being here, for listening, for being a part of this community.
We love you so much.